This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. William Alexander can be compared to a crusader, a man on a quest for the Holy Grail. The acclaimed author of the $64 tomato decided that for 1 year he would bake a loaf of bread a week. Not just any bread, no croissants nor dinner rolls. Alexander wanted to perfect a peasant bread he once tasted. In the course of his odyssey, he grows and grinds his own wheat, wins second place in a New York State Fair bread contest, and revives the art of bread making in a 1,300-year-old monastery in Normandy. The results and some recipes are in his new book about the experience, 52 Loaves, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meaning, and the Perfect Crust. William Alexander is in our New York studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us about that marvelous bread that you tasted and tried to duplicate.
And I must have been close to, 50 when I first tasted really good artisan bread. And it was just an eye-opener. The first bite into the crust, which managed to be both crispy and chewy at the same time and had a natural sweetness from the sugars that are developed during baking. And the crumb, which is the word that bakers use to describe the interior of the bread, the crumb had some bite back when you bit into it. And as Anne and I left the table, I can recall saying to her, I've got to learn to bake that bread if it kills me.
Anne is your wife, and she stood by you during this whole process. But the bread that you're making, the ingredients, four: water, yeast, flour, salt. With such simple ingredients, why isn't baking this bread a simple process?
You would think it would be, and I was thrilled to see that no less a cook than Julia Child asked that same question. And what she said is, there are only four ingredients, but there seem to be 10,000 ways to use them. And that is precisely the problem with baking bread.
Did you eat all the loaves you baked?
Every single one, and my wife and my kids, and they were all real troopers, and they never complained once, even when the bread was lousy. And I baked a lot of lousy bread, let me tell you.
Yeah, but was your definition of lousy different from your family's?
Yes.
I mean, you were looking for this diamond, right?
So I was looking for the diamond, and, I had a very specific notion of what I wanted this bread to be. And I remember at one point, having bread with the family and saying, oh, once again, no holes in the bread. And my daughter, Katie, she was so exasperated. She said, Dad, what's with you and the air holes? I think this bread is great now. It wasn't bad bread, but it wasn't perfect bread. I was trying to bake the perfect loaf of bread.
Yeah. You decided to grow wheat. Now, you live in the Catskill, the valley, in the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did at any time in that process, from seed to flour, spelled F-L-O-U-R, flour, did you question your sanity?
Oh, my goodness. I am convinced that if we all had to grow and thresh and winnow and grind our own wheat, we'd be a nation of rice eaters today. I mean, a threshing of the wheat is today that will not long be forgotten in our family. Threshing is the process of separating the wheat berries from the seed head. And nature wants them to stay on the seed head. And so you have to basically beat the living daylights out of the wheat to get this out. So not knowing how to thresh wheat, I went to a venerable source, Pliny the Elder, writing in A.D. 77. And Pliny talked about two ways in fashion at the time, having a team of oxen trample and using a flail. And having lent out my oxen for the weekend, and my wife took one look at the flail, which, if you can try to picture this, two heavy wooden sticks connected by a short length of heavy chain. She took one look at that and wondered where and with whom I've been hanging out. It really looks something more likely to be found smacking in the buttocks of a member of parliament in a London S&N den than used in the preparation of food. So we put that aside, and after starting first with a broom, which got destroyed in the first 5 minutes, and then we went to shovels, and we ended up doing 20 pounds of wheat, just holding a few staves at a time, taking turns pounding it with one of my woodworking mallets. And after like 8 hours of that, I can still see Anne just lying on the back lawn, just exhausted and sunburned and looking every bit as threshed as the wheat. And she said, "Promise me just one thing." I said, "What's that, dear?" She said, "Next year you won't grow cotton."
I'm speaking with William Alexander, author of 52 Loaves, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meaning, and a Perfect Crust. So, did you find truth?
I found lots of truths. I have to be honest, I really started out just wanting to bake a decent loaf of bread. You know, as I was baking my last loaf of bread, and it was the middle of winter, and actually it started to snow, and I was baking a loaf that I had made from my own wheat that I had threshed and then ground into flour, and it was leavened with my own yeast that I had cultured from the wild yeast that was sitting on apples in my backyard, baking it in an oven that I had built from the earth in my yard. And I was thinking about, you know, had I baked the perfect loaf? I thought of a story I hadn't thought of in years, Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Birthmark, which is about a man who has a perfect wife, except for one small flaw, the birthmark on her cheek. And he actually ends up killing her, trying to go from almost perfect to perfect. And he has a wonderful line about how his character was failing to find the perfect future in the present. And I thought, you know, the question isn't to ask, did I bake the perfect loaf? I think it was more about learning to find the perfect future in the present.
William Alexander is the author of 52 Loaves, One Man's Relentless Pursuit of Truth, Meaning, and a Perfect Crust. He joined us from New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Leanne.
As we just heard from Scott Horsley last night in the nation's capital, the president shared a lighter moment with the press corps. He broke bread and cracked jokes at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. It's a time-honored tradition, and Mr. Obama said he wasn't sure he should attend, but the vice president encouraged him.
Biden talked me into it. He leaned over and he said, "Mr. President, this is no ordinary dinner. This is a big meal."
In a hotel ballroom packed with journalists, politicians, and celebrities, the president gave a shout-out on behalf of his daughters to the tween heartthrobs, the Jonas Brothers.
Sasha and Malia are huge fans, but boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you: predator drones. You will never see it coming.
The president's routine was an opening act for the event's headline comic, Jay Leno of The Tonight Show.
And sometimes the press can be one-sided. As you mentioned, all during the election, they would ask things like, "Is Obama black enough? Is Obama too black?" It's never the other way around. "Is John Boehner orange enough?"
Before the night was over, the president got in a jab at Wall Street.
By the way, all of the jokes here tonight are brought to you by our friends at Goldman Sachs. So you don't have to worry. They make money whether you laugh or not.
The comic stylings of President Barack Obama last night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. A California obstetrician is among the many people helping with the ongoing relief effort in Haiti. Physicians in disaster zones often work without reliable access to electricity. Laura Stachel's handmade solar-powered kits are filling that need. Rachel Dornhelm has this profile.
It's really important that you remember what to do when you're in the field. So I'm going to open up one of the solar suitcases.
Laura Stachel is crouching on the floor of her Berkeley kitchen. She lifts the cover of a black carry-on. There are no clothes inside, just a sheet of plywood mounted with four electrical components.
Okay, do you remember what these wires are for?
These are the external connectors. They go to the solar panel.
That's right.
These fit into the circuit breaker?
Stachel's quizzing aid volunteer, Paul LeCoursiere, who's leaving for earthquake-ravaged Haiti in a few days. He's going to take this solar suitcase with him and plans to deliver it by donkey to a remote medical clinic that currently depends on candles for light.
Right. So we have a charge controller that's regulating the energy that's coming in from the panel.
Stachel sounds like she might be a solar engineer. She's actually a medical doctor, an obstetrician whose idea for the suitcase spun out of her work in maternal child health in Nigeria. She says she was observing a hospital there in 2008 when she realized for several hours each day, power was rationed.
One of the first cases that I watched, which was a C-section, the lights completely went out during a C-section and the physicians had to finish by flashlight. There were other situations where midwives were taking care of women who were bleeding to death who needed emergency surgeries, but there was no phone system to actually call a doctor.
Stachel says she described the problems in emails to her husband, who does work on solar for a living. He suggested a sun-powered solution. When she got home, they designed a large permanent solar installation for the hospital. But Stachel insisted on a smaller test run first.
So I asked him to create something I could bring in my suitcase that I could take through customs without having to declare any special equipment.
Stachel says after seeing how it could power LED lights and walkie-talkies, no one at the Nigerian hospital would let her take the trial suitcase away. Suddenly, she was getting requests for solar suitcases from medical clinics all over Nigeria, more recently from all over the world. And that's how their organization, We Care Solar, was born.
We didn't mean to turn our house into the solar suitcase factory, but it happened. It's been fun.
That's Stachel's husband, Hal Aronson. He says the suitcases don't just provide light and communication. They can be expanded to power equipment like ultrasound and suction machines. Each suitcase costs about $1,000 for the materials. The husband-wife team are scraping together those funds from their personal savings and donations. The $1,000 price tag doesn't include labor. But Stachel and Aronson's infectious enthusiasm has been a boost, netting help from UC Berkeley students, solar hobbyists, even a class of high schoolers.
And now we're beginning to drill the holes in the template where all the wire is going to eventually go.
Like this engineering class at Cosumnes Oaks High School, just outside Sacramento.
I'm Kyle Betancourt. I'm a sophomore. I think it's really cool that we can help save lives in just other countries without even having to be there.
Betancourt's teacher heard about the suitcases at a solar education workshop last summer. So far, the class has made 12 suitcases. They're working on four more that UNICEF requested for Uganda. Stachel says there are about 20 units now working in Nigeria, Tanzania, Mexico, Haiti, and the Thai-Burmese border.
One of our dreams is to teach people how to make solar suitcases where they live so they can have their own industries and they can be supplying these things for their own communities and healthcare centers.
In the meantime, there's a steady stream of visitors to their house, like Paul LeCoursiere, who's heading off to Haiti. Before he leaves their home, Stachel brings a big bag of accessories to add to the suitcase.
I always feel like I'm like handing off one of my offspring here.
I can imagine. LeCoursiere leaves, but Stachel and Aronson remain at the table working over another set of solar panels. An African doctor headed to Zimbabwe is coming by for this suitcase within the hour. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Dornhelm.